And now, the transcredible exploits of Zap Brannigan, brought to you by Bartley's Rocket Wax.
I wax my rocket every day.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Screen Geeks Radio, episode 118. This is Dave.
This is Barry.
This is the human Vuvuzela.
Oh, wow. There you go. Well, I see all of America has quit caring about soccer now by now because, you know, they lost. So they like it, you know, while they have a chance. And then as soon as they lose, screw it.
So honestly, I mean, for listeners, first of all, I apologize. I'm at half speed today. I'm still on Maui time. I just got back from Maui a day ago now. But we lost the World Cup?
We're out of it. Yeah,
oh, we're out of it? Okay.
I never cared enough to keep track in the first place. So, yeah.
Okay.
Go Team Canada!
There you go.
Go Canada.
I just figured, you know, I don't like a lot of stuff that happens in World Cup, and someone said, well, soccer doesn't need you. Well, okay, that's okay. I don't need soccer, to quote Mr. Billy Flynn.
Typical geek response. We're like, sports, we don't need sports. We have movies.
Well, unless it's roller derby.
Soccer is the ultimate sport for, like, the outcast, though. Because it's like when you're, like, a five-year-old kid, you can just run around and not really do anything, and you're okay. You know, if you're, like, socially accepted, you play baseball.
Did you see the Stephen Colbert thing about the World Cup?
No, I didn't.
He had two guys, a journalist on each side, pro-soccer and anti-soccer. And the pro-soccer guy's like, look, we're in our fifth decade of soccer's going to take over the country anytime now. And Colbert told the other guy, look, you know, they're talking about how the midfieldsman, whatever, runs like 3 miles in a game. And Colbert's simple response was, no one pays to watch someone jog. Which works for me.
Oh, for Pete's sake. I love soccer. I love playing it, too, as a kid.
But I like watching a game. I've been to a pro game when I was in Nepal, of all places, and that was a blast. But watching it on TV, I might as well be watching baseball or golf.
I miss Pele when I was a kid. I used to watch Pele. You know, Pele, he would, like, do that kick where he would flip and do, like, a matrix and flip, like, in a total circle. I miss that kind of, like, wow.
But we have Ronaldo now.
We got Ronaldo and we've got Beckham.
There you go.
So.
The sport is saved.
Yay.
An Air Bud.
And Air Bud. Well, there you go. That
goes without saying.
Yes, that's the clincher right there. Wow. Well, Barry, without getting into what our main topic is going to be, what have you watched this past week or so that you would like to share?
Well, you know, this morning I wanted to watch something that meant a lot to me, and you know, in a way, kind of brought me back to Maui. So I threw on Punch Drunk Love, which is nice. Still my favorite film of 2002. Without really getting into it, because that movie is kind of worthy of its own episode or topic. But some of the things I always feel while I'm watching it, and some things that kind of occurred to me this morning. It's my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie, and I know it, you know, many people will disagree with me, and that's understandable. It doesn't have the majestic epic scope of There Will Be Blood, but like that film and like Hard Eight, Punch Drunk Love kind of exists in its own universe. It doesn't feel like it's existing on planet Earth, and I don't mean that as an insult. It's so dreamlike and so surrealistic. I don't understand all of it. It's funny that even years now later, I still don't really get what the harmonium is about. I don't understand what the car crash in the opening scene is about. Adam Sandler's performance is really something else. Every time I watch it, it's like, it's weird that his performance is so grounded in reality while the rest of the movie is kind of out there in La La Land somewhere. He's basically just playing a very realistic, very harshly brutal version. Like, what if Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison were real people and they really had to deal with being real people? What would that be like? So, like, all the awkwardness that's in all of his performances, all the awkwardness, all the, you know, all the things that make him relatable are all of a sudden very uncomfortable. And the movie never tells you if you should like him or not, which I love how dangerous the movie is. The whole movie is so dangerous. You never get the sense of where it's going from scene to scene. And I love that sense of it. I love any film where you don't know where it's going. Punch Drunk Love is really one of the most original American movies, and I love that Anderson continues to be one of our most original American directors. So, saw that. I'll talk about all the films I saw at the Maui Film Festival. I do want to mention The Karate Kid. I did see The Karate Kid remake.
Oh, okay.
And I'll be honest, I went in there just ready to just hate every minute of it. And at over 2 hours, it's way too long. And no question, this story, there's nothing fresh anymore. Every moment is completely predictable. You're always a step ahead of the movie, even if you haven't seen the original. And it's funny how much it completely copies the original. What I think makes the remake of The Karate Kid worth seeing is
it Justin Bieber song?
Oh, boy. That was bad. actually, not that. No, the strength of Jackie Chan's performance really did kind of floor me. because he isn't playing, he isn't doing what Pat Morita does. He actually makes the character his own. There's a real sense of sadness there. The strength of his performance was really, really startling. I know he's been doing some films recently that kind of stretched him as an actor, and I don't mean The Spy Next Door, but he actually did an all Chinese language film recently where it was actually a dramatic performance. It wasn't an action movie. I can't even underscore how surprised I was by his performance. It's that good, and the key scenes in the film he really makes quite moving. So if anything, I think the movie's worth seeing for Shannon's performance. Jaden Smith, he's appealing, but it's not a good performance by any means. This is a step down from The Pursuit of Happiness, although a step up from the Day the Earth Stood Still. So worth seeing, but not a great movie. I mean, it's so freaking predictable. And again, you know, it's because this story has been done so many times. And it's nowhere near as good as the original, to say the least. But I was surprised how much I did enjoy it because of Shannon's performance. And I think that's it. And we'll talk about Night and Day in a bit. Yeah, I guess that's all I want to say for now.
Okay, I'll go next and save the honor of last for our birthday boy, Ethan. Yeah. All right, well, I watched a lot over the last couple of weeks. Do I start on TV or movies first? I'll start on TV. Hey, shocker, in case you didn't notice by the opener, Futurama's back, and the world is a better and happier place for it. It feels like they're still just trying to get a little bit of the rhythm back from the movies, the feature-length movies that were kind of a bomb, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. They're coming back into their own very quickly. The first episode is kind of wrapping up any consequences from the movie series, and the second episode is a Zap Brannigan episode, and it is hilarious and wrong in all the right ways that you want Futurama to be. Yeah, it's goodness. I'm so glad it's back, and life is happy. And I've also been taking a bit of a trip down memory lane. Costco has various volumes of Tailspin and DuckTales for $9 a piece.
Wow.
So we've been going down the DuckTales road. And
DuckTales, woo.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And now it's stuck in your head for the next 3 days. I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, yeah. And we started watching Tailspin. Fun shows from the 80s. It's just, they hold up. They're fun. They're goofy. It's not as good as Animaniacs, but it's not meant to be. It's
totally... DuckTales does hold up, it does?
I think so. It's still pretty stinking fun. Yeah, cool. Absolutely. Launchpad is still awesome.
I like Launchpad.
Launchpad's the man. Let's see. Any other TV stuff I've been watching? I've kind of got stuff. Sanctuary we're catching up on still is pretty good. Not really much else to say. I guess I'll move on to movies then. Continuing the journey through the Herzog box set, I watched Lessons on Darkness this morning, which is a documentary where he essentially goes through and looks at the aftermath of Kuwait after the Gulf War. One. I don't know if we're in Gulf War 2 or whatever now, but whatever. You know what I mean.
So the one in the 90s.
Yes, and it's really a hard look, but it's a beautiful film. I mean, the man knows cinematography. Like, the people he works with just know what they're doing, and they make him look incredibly good. It's heartbreaking because you see, you know, they'll be flying out, doing a helicopter flyover, and it looks like, you know, there's lakes, you know, the water's, you know, it's places, the entire property's kind of underwater until he says, that's not water, that's all oil, actually. Mm. So it's completely uninhabitable, and it's really heartbreaking, the things that the soldiers did to the people there, and it's a very powerful film. Every movie I watch of Herzog's makes me respect him more and more, pretty much every time.
Cool.
I revisited A Scanner Darkly last night. Amazon has the Blu-ray for $8 right now. So I was like, I had a gift certificate. I couldn't go wrong. And that movie really holds up well. And it reminds me of when I first saw it, how surprised I was that it was essentially a comedy for the most part.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the comedic bits. I mean, the whole part about the bike missing mm-hmm. 16 speeds or whatever it yep. was. And, you know, the note on the door. There's all these great funny scenes about it, but it's also a very poignant film, I thought, too.
Yeah.
Without being overly preachy, mm-hmm. which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
Fun movie. What's next?
Fun movie, really?
I think fun. So. Well, no, those funny parts.
It moves me so much at the end that I don't know if I'd say fun, but I mean, I'm with you. I think it's the best film of that year. I love that film.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's fun for those fun parts. I mean, those are parts that you tend to remember very easily.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is a very poignant film, I think. Also watched the newest Lewis Black special, Stark Raving Black.
Is it good?
I thought it was amazing. There was a point in time where I kind of fell off the Lewis Black bandwagon just because he went so hard one way politically.
Mm.
I really enjoyed him when he was hitting both sides.
Yeah.
And this one, he gets back to it. Like within the first 10 minutes, he talks about how the two-party system is essentially a bowl of crap looking in a mirror at itself. It's just beautiful stuff. There are great stories. There's a great story about how he's talking about becoming a mainstream comic and he's opening up for Vince Gill. I know Vince Gill's opening up for him, and just how he's becoming more and more demoralized with every single little thing that happens in the act. It's hilarious.
Sounds good.
It's a bit more introspective, kind of like Carlin's later work. Especially near the end, he gets a lot more introspective and serious, but it's still really good. I think it's very much a return to form for him.
Cool.
Holy crap, I've watched so much. I finally finished going through every single flippin' extra on Official Rejection. Both commentaries, all the extended interviews, everything. If you have a chance, pick it up. If you're at all interested in the festival scene, it's a film that's very well worth watching. Because watching it as many times as I have lately, something that really comes across is that this movie could have been a film very much about sour grapes. About how, you know, Sundance has gotten away from what it was and all that stuff. But the film has that part at the beginning, but refocuses and it becomes very positive. Where do we go from here? What can we do? How can we be successful? And it's very entertaining at the same time. Except for the Chicago Indies Fest part. That still gets me every single time I watch it.
It's horrifying. Horrifying scene.
Yeah. But very good film. Last two things. We watched The Fall last night.
Oh, the Tarsem Singh film.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Not a fan, I gotta say.
How come?
The story just felt all over the place. Honestly.
What about all the visuals out of a Madonna video? Did that not do much for you?
Not so much. Not so much. You know, it just, the narrative just kind of felt kind of disjointed all over the place. And now, granted, in the framework of what the story is and his motivations in telling the story, shall we say, it kind of made sense. But I just didn't like it. I really can't explain it beyond that. Just what he does in spite to try to tear this little girl down at the end through that story really made it a very ugly, ugly film.
Tear the girl down.
Yeah, after, oh goodness, when she's in the bed.
The way he manipulates her?
Well, no, the way, after she is hospitalized again, I'll say,
yeah.
And he's coming in and finishing the story,
mm-hmm.
The way he says, he's just so embittered and angry as a person, he's essentially saying, you can't have any purity, I'm going to kill all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got so ugly. And I don't know, I mean, maybe that it very well could be that that's, you know, a tribute to the film, because it gave me that strong of a reaction. But beforehand, I didn't feel like I had the payoff of it. It was like, man, this guy just needs to die and get it over with.
That's not how it ended, though.
I know. But he still took a very nasty, nasty turn.
Well, he was a suicidal stuntman.
This is true. It just crossed me wrong. That's really what it comes down to. Visually, I thought it was astounding.
You weren't moved by the relationship between Lee Pace and the little girl? And the strength of the little girl's performance?
Oh, the little girl was amazing in it. Yeah, she needs to be doing more work as she gets older, because I think she was the anchor of it. If they had any less capable actress in that, the film would have completely fallen apart for me.
Mm-hmm.
But she was the one thing that kept us watching it. But yeah. But visually, it was unlike anything I've ever seen.
I was going to mention on the Movie Club podcast, which is this podcast which consists of two guys from Film Junk and a few guys from some other websites, they had a discussion on it recently,
mm-hmm.
which was like nearly 90 minutes long. It's a pretty interesting wow. listen. It's actually a pretty heated argument, because they get into arguments about the visuals, and like Jay Cheel from Film Junk was kind of arguing the visuals, they're not bad, but they're pretty much just like stuff from a music video in 1994. So it's a pretty interesting discussion.
Wow. I don't think I could agree with that, but very interesting.
No. Singe, you know, he has a very specific style, and, you know, and I think that, you know, you see that in The Cell, obviously, as well. No, I think parts of it, you know, they do have like that, you know, Vidal Sassoon, you know, or like that Janet Jackson Love Will Never Do Without You look to it. But because the film was, you know, took 4 years to make, shot on all these different continents, I think, you know, there are parts of it that have a familiarity to it. But I think that most of it, I mean, when was the last time you saw a movie where people are swimming with elephants? Really?
That
swimming
was brilliant.
With elephants. Or the part where they go to that tribe. Thank you. Well, the part where they're at that tribe and the map is like appearing in that guy's back. I mean, there's to me, the film is just, you know, just a sea of just incredible visuals.
It absolutely is. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll say, did you see Toy Story, Ethan?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll save that for your spot then. Last thing I saw was I had the chance to go see The Complete Metropolis in Denver.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
And
good
this
for
was
you.
Yeah, this was the first time I've ever seen Metropolis.
Oh, perfect.
I'm sure you remember when we talked about it. I was toying with either watching it on Netflix or...
Yeah.
And as soon as I found out it was coming, I'm like, well, that answered the question. And it was at Chez Artiste up in Denver, and it's in their screening room. I don't know if you've been
just
in there.
It's the one in the back with the red curtain, right?
Yeah.
I love that room. It's my favorite.
It's a really intimate room. It holds, what, like 7,500 people at mm-hmm. most?
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe,
yeah. Squeeze them all in there. Yeah, was it pretty packed when you saw it?
It was probably about 3/4 full, and it was a 4:30 p.m. screening.
Did you go by yourself, or did you?
I met a friend I used to work with up there.
Cool.
And he'd never seen it either. And the film is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, there are parts of it from the restoration that look as good as anything you've seen in Young Frankenstein is probably the best way I can put it. Just that sharpness and clarity.
Yeah.
They really did a first-class job on the restoration. The recovered scenes don't fare near as well.
Hmm.
But I'm glad they were in there. Having never seen the film before, I don't think it would have felt as complete an experience if I hadn't seen those scenes.
Okay.
What I really loved about it, just before I get into the film, the actual content of the film, was that they didn't recover all of the footage. But they got a hold of the censorship records from the Germans so that they knew what was cut and what was missing.
Right.
So they actually bring up a scene saying, okay, yeah, we don't have the film, but this is what happens in this scene, which really fleshed it out even more. And I really appreciated that attention to detail. Now, for a 1927 movie, the scope of this thing is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, when you have those wide shots of the city, and I know, sure, they're little planes on strings and whatever, but just to do that kind of scope just was beautiful. The story was great. What really, I'm not a big silent film fan. I should get that out of the way. And usually I'm used to seeing them where it's, you know, you see talking, and then they show you what they've said. And what I really appreciated was that Metropolis essentially gives you the opening to that conversation, and the acting is strong enough that you can still follow the conversation without getting every line.
Yeah.
Some of it's over the top, sure, whatever, but I thought it was a great story. I loved it. I can't wait to buy this thing in November when it comes out. If it comes near you, you owe it to yourself to see it on the big screen. And they essentially re-recorded the entire score, too.
Great.
So it sounds beautiful. It looks great. It's a powerful film. I loved it. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. I love that. This version is as definitive as you can come by. The version that was released in 1984, most Metropolis fans found pretty appalling. It was partially colorized.
Oh, wow.
With the score done by Giorgio Moroder, you know, who did Flashdance and parts of...
is that the one with the metal soundtrack?
I don't know about if I'd call it metal. It's more of an 80s pop soundtrack. It's got Eurythmics on it. And what they
wow.
do, parts of it, they actually do stop and show like all of a sudden it's like a Star Wars crawl. They've got these title cards telling you the scenes that are missing, but there were so many of them that after a while I really did feel like I'm just reading the film as opposed to watching them. And they would show like little pictures here and there of the scenes that were cut and lost, and you really get the sense like, wow, this film really is heavily compromised. So it's cool that what you got to see was very as close as definitive as we can.
Yeah, yeah, and get. You know, like the scenes with the preacher in the pulpit and stuff like that were great little scenes to have, and you can definitely tell when they're different. You know, they're different scenes, but they clean them up as much as they're gonna get cleaned up, and it still looks good. It doesn't detract from the experience.
Great, great.
And well, I think so that's actually it. Yes, so am I. Ethan, sir, what have you been watching?
Before I do this, we don't have a topic this week, right?
Well, actually, yes, we do. Mr. Barry's going to be talking about his experiences at the Maui Film Festival.
Okay, I'll just talk about, to get to the point, I'll just talk about what I was going to talk about what I watched last week as well, but I'll just talk about what I watched this week then.
Okay, you can do both.
Yeah, you can do both. Take your time.
Okay.
It's all good.
Let me just scroll down on my blog here. And here we go.
Is that your bionic scrolling?
I watched Wise Blood, directed by John Huston and starring Brad Dourif. Have either of you seen this?
No, movie? I'm intrigued. I like that combo. How is it?
It's a pretty weird movie, and it took me a while to kind of get into it because I kind of expected this typical like searing drama that was about, you know, a screed against religion, but it's more about... Well, actually, I should tell what it's about first. Brad Dourif is this guy who's like just gotten back, I think, from the army, and he has nothing to do or no prospects, no career, no family. So he starts a religion, basically, or at least he tries to. And basically, you follow him as that, and he's like competing with other people. And there's this like halfway through the movie, he's attempting to give a sermon, and Ned Beatty appears, and he's like watching him, and Ned Beatty kind of comes in, and he's very charismatic, and he's like convincing people. He's like, yeah, do this. But Brad Dourif is like, no. So, yeah, it's a really weird and deliberately paced movie, and it's almost a bit of a comedy about human nature. And there, I guess there's a bit of a spoiler here, but there's a climactic action near the end that is intercut with a guy running around in a gorilla suit. And I was a little like, what the F is this? But I kind of realized the metaphor that Houston was making, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. So it's a movie I'd really like to rewatch, but it was really good. Next, I finally watched The Road. Oh. And no, it did not make me want to watch Old Dogs. But I really liked it. A bit of a problem is that it's kind of like Watchmen, where it's extremely literal adaptation, and that kind of hurts just the structure and pacing of the movie a bit. But I think it really helped that Viggo Mortensen, as an actor, he felt like the perfect person to kind of deliver Cormac McCarthy's prose in the voiceover, where if you got someone else, even a good actor, it might have just come off wrong. So yeah, it worked for me overall. It had its problems, but it was a powerful film. I watched Jim Jarmusch's Mystery Train, which I loved.
That's on my Netflix queue. I can't wait to watch it.
Beautiful film.
Yeah, it's it's typical Jarmusch in that it's a vignette movie, but it's very much about non-dramatic moments. Yeah. It's not about, you know, having contrived ways for them to, like, I mean, they do interconnect in ways, but it's not like a babble or something, or a crash where it's like, this means this because this happens. It's just, you know, a nice little moody comedy. And three, Tom Waits, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and Joe Strummer are in it, a typical Jarmusch trademark casting musicians in the acting roles, and they're all very good in it. So yeah, I liked it a lot.
Did you like? Let me ask you really quick. My favorite of the vignettes is the opening with the Japanese couple. I could watch Yuki Kudo put on lipstick all day. Do you have a favorite of the vignettes?
I almost want to. Probably the last one with Joe Strummer, Steve Buscemi, and the other guy. And the middle one is probably the weakest, but it has that great scene with Tom Noonan. So mm-hmm,
that's right.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Next, I watched the Todd Haynes film Safe.
Oh, wow.
Which, that's a heck of a film. That's a very interesting movie. It's been a week since I've watched it, but I've like been dreaming about that movie. So it's stayed with me. It's pretty hard to describe, but...
Julianne Moore is awesome.
Yeah, best performance of 1995 there. How should I describe it further? No, just see it for yourself, because it's hard to describe if you haven't. And I watched The Wolfman. Total travesty. Terrible, terrible film.
The Joe Johnson version. Okay.
Yeah, I...
Just so we're clear.
Yeah, I... Oh, man, this movie... The problem is that it's kind of... It's either it's a painfully dull costume drama for most of the movie... And then it becomes like this horror movie where it's very just unexciting and uninspired. And like, I like the fact that they used the practical effects for the Wolfman. I'm glad they did that. But just overall, there's no passion to this movie. Like the violence in it, like all the beheadings and such, it felt so obligatory. It's like there's no passion to it. And all the actors in it just don't give a crap. So that's really what hurts the costume drama aspect of it. And yeah, I just... Total travesty.
Well, for me, it's a guilty pleasure. It's a mess. And I think Benicio del Toro's performance is one of the biggest problems. I mean, you're right. His heart is not in it. He seems embarrassed by it. And I think that really killed the movie. Anthony Hopkins, likewise, you're right. He doesn't seem to give a crap. But I think that kind of comes out in a fun way. I think he clearly enjoys such a, I don't know, this is like one of his... He just enjoys chewing the scenery so much in this one. I had a lot of fun watching.
Like in a Robert Patrick Marine kind of way?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I would go with that.
Watch it. Okay.
Yeah, no, Wolfman, not a great movie. I agree. I agree with Ethan. It's not a great... For me, it's a guilty pleasure because I think the wolf attack scenes are a lot of fun. But yeah, the others... The scenes with the human beings, especially the love story scenes between Emily Blunt and Benicio del Toro, just deadly.
Brutal.
Because again, even though he's the executive producer, he looks really embarrassed to be there. I think he realized this was not going to be Che Guevara all over again. He looks really embarrassed to be in this Wolfman movie. But no, the makeup effects of that were great. The wolf attack scenes, yeah, they're obligatory. You've seen them done before. But for me, they were fun. But no, not a great movie. The kind of movie you'd watch at a Halloween party, be like, yay, but definitely not a great film. It's not Bram Stoker's Dracula, that's for sure.
It's the only movie this year that is more boring than Iron Man 2 to me. Wow. So.
Oh, I got a contender for you a little later.
Yeah,
and
Clash of the Titans.
Finally,
for me. Anyway,
I that was boring too.
One in Rome.
And I guess Remember Me was at least kind of so excruciating that it was kind of like entertaining in a way.
Okay, you brought it up. Did you see Bill Simmons? Do you read Bill Simmons' column at all?
No.
He's a sports guy. Hang on, I got to bring this up. I put it on my Facebook. This is a guy who he's a sports writer for ESPN, but his wife and daughter love Twilight, so they ended up getting Remember Me on demand watching or whatever. Mm. And his description, hang on, where is he? There it is. Okay. It's brilliant what he said. He brings it up in a way I'd never really even thought of. Come on. See, this is what you try. This is what happens when you try to do stuff on the fly. It just doesn't work so well.
Okay. Are we still recording?
Yeah, we are.
Quiet.
Okay, oh, no, we're recording.
Like,
oh,
it's
yeah.
So quiet now.
I know. It's because flipping. Oh, for the love of Pez, people. Oh, well. Go ahead, sir. I'll come back to it in a minute. Go ahead and keep going with your list.
I was talking about Toy Story 3.
Yeah.
You guys want to talk about what you thought about that?
Oh, before we get to it, here it is, finally. Okay.
All right, so this is Bill Simmons on Remember Me.
Yes, the sports guy, yes. Just so you know, I'd never seen Pattinson act until Remember Me. He's like a cross between Keanu Reeves, Tommy Wiseau, and every athlete who's ever made an Entourage cameo. He's fantastically, historically, mesmerizingly bad. He's so bad at acting that I couldn't stop watching the movie. I found myself rooting for him. Come on, Pattinson, you can pull this off. Just give us one scene. And it didn't happen. So, yeah.
That sums it up for me.
It was the Tommy Wiseau thing that really just...
No, I like Tommy Wiseau more. He's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I think bad can be interesting. Pattinson isn't interesting. You know, it's like Keanu Reeves. I mean, when he is really... When he gives a great performance, he tends to erase the bad ones. Pattinson, I don't think for me, he'll never erase Little Ashes. There's nothing like watching someone trying to play Salvador Dali and, like, their accent, their Spanish accent is, like, on and off in mid-sentence. I mean, it was that bad. It was amazingly bad performance.
Okay, let's move on to Toy Story 3. Since it is your time, sir, why don't you go first, Ethan? What did you think of it?
I really liked it overall, though. I had a few qualms with it, and I'll say I think a bit of the problem was that I think it kind of covered a lot of the same ground that the second one already did. And that just took me a little out of it, like kind of like, you know, the fear of abandonment and the toys having to, you know, make an escape or a rescue. So that was just a little redundant, I felt. But overall, it's a very emotionally satisfying, entertaining movie. And there are a few dreadful musical choices, I'll just say that. But I did like it a lot.
Barry? My review's up, so I don't have a whole lot to say.
Okay. Well, I like the film. Certainly, I gave it a 5-star spot in my Maui Time review. But... yeah, you know, I love the film, and I could certainly get behind it. I didn't like it more than Up. I didn't like it that much. And it's not the best thing I've seen this year. Not to say that there's a lot of other films that were better. In fact, I think it's one of the funniest films I've seen this year. What I liked about it was that, like the best Pixar movies, it deals with really dark issues. And there were parts of it I thought were really tough to watch. I think it's one of the toughest movies to ever bear the Disney name since Pinocchio. I would put it up there, mm-hmm. Dealing with those issues. There is a scene in the movie, without spoiling it, where our heroes are in a situation that looks like they're absolutely screwed. And I thought that was pretty devastating in the way it dealt with that. I wasn't bawling like a child at the end, like everyone said I would be. So I guess I was a little disappointed by that. I didn't think it was quite the emotional catharsis I wanted. And yeah, I mean, a lot of this you have seen before, but a lot of it you haven't. I loved the Ned Beatty character, the purple bear. I love the direction they went there.
I love the fact that they kept him true to his character the whole way through.
Yeah, because initially I thought he was very annoying. I'm like, oh, I don't like this new guy. But then when they show the direction they're going with him, like, oh, okay, this is great. I really like this. And Michael Keaton is back in full comic brilliance as Ken. One of my favorite comic performances of the year, and he was just comic gold whenever he opened his mouth. I think it's a wonderful film. I really, really do. I think it's already one of the most overrated films of the year. I think it's easy to be like kind of gushing over the movie, and I'm not quite there, but on one hand, it's a little overrated. On the other hand, it is the real deal. It's the best thing out right now, and it's a beautiful film.
Yeah, and while I gave it a 9.5 out of 10...
Why a 9.5?
You know... Part of it was the animation just didn't seem quite right, and I didn't know if it was the 3D or what. there are spots where the characters are talking where it looked like it was stop motion, like something out of The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Interesting.
Than it did Toy Story. And I hate to say it, but I noticed it even when I watched it in 2D the second time.
The 3D I thought was useless. I saw it in 3D.
The opening scene, that opening adventure scene was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But that was about, and even then, Pixar already creates a 3D world in 2D as it is. You don't need the 3D glasses.
You're right. There were some moments in the opening scene, but the opening scene is so freaking great by itself. It didn't need it. And I got to say, that opening scene, like it is completely self-referential, but it's everything. It does everything right that those Shrek sequels did wrong. You know, it's
it
teases itself and it references itself. But in a way that's not so overly in your face. Like, I don't know, it didn't feel so smarmy the way the Shrek movies are so smarmy.
Yeah, I will say the 3D was, it did add an extra layer of depth during the day and night in short.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll have to agree with you on that.
But again, it wasn't necessary. And no. I love that short. I think that's the best short they've done yet.
There were trailers to movies before Toy Story 3. I thought the 3D, because the trailers were in 3D, I thought they were, it's weird, like, I've seen Despicable Me and I don't like the film. But the trailer, the 3D in that, I thought was better than anything in Toy Story 3, 3D-wise.
Yeah, there's just no need for it. And that's just what really kept it. I mean, if you're going to go for a 10, you have to look at it warts and all. And I will even admit that if you don't come from the point of view that's going to set you up to like this in the first place, you're not going to agree with me, and I'm perfectly cool with that. And that is, you know, I didn't have a lot of friends growing up. I'm an only child, and, you know, I played with my toys a whole heck of a lot as a kid. So I identified with a lot of that throughout that film. So on that level, I don't expect other people to connect with the film.
I was going to mention, Andy's kind of a loser. Like, he has no friends. Like, he's always just videotaped playing with his toys, and he has no dad, and... That kid comes from a broken home, man.
Aw.
You just made it even sadder.
That's
okay,
one way to look at it. I mean, maybe you just don't see his friends, guys. I don't know if I'd say he has no friends. I don't think you see them. You know, I mean, we're kind of in his world. We get glimpses of his world. And pretty much everything we see is from either the toys' point of view or the toys aren't that far behind. But
well,
I don't know.
I want to mention, too, when Andy, he's growing up, too, and he has a laptop, and he's a teenager, and the toys are in his room, so the... I'm just saying the toys must have witnessed him.
Hey. That's like me making the jokes about, well, Andy's going off to college. He's moved on to different kinds of toys.
Oh, brother.
Yeah.
Well, who was it? Somebody. Oh, I know. It was Tim Allen. They were interviewing Tim Allen, and he said initially he was against the film because he says, you know, problem number one, why would Andy bring a toy to college? He's like, and he's like, why would it be Woody? He's like, wouldn't someone put a Buzz Lightyear on their shelf and it'd be like there for ironic purposes? Why would you put a toy cowboy in your, you know, in your dorm unless you were making some kind of very specific statement? And I'll leave it at that. Anyway, I thought Alan had a really good point there, but, you know, of course, he said he made the film because he loved the film and he saw the whole scope of it.
Well, have you guys seen what Harry Knowles said about it?
No. I think I read his review. I don't remember what he said. He
essentially talked about how he thought Woody was his dad's toy, which is why there was that special bond.
That's a cool point.
But it made him hate the movie going that route because, well, then why would he give up the toy so easily at the end?
I don't know if he gave it up so easily, though.
He didn't, but still.
Because, I mean, I think that was one of the most, you know, again, the ending did not, like, have me bawling.
I did
think it was moving enough because, it is about, like, that point you get in your life where you do have to let go of these childlike things. But I think there is a really great thing about how, like, you know, for example, like, you know, Dave and I, when we eventually are fathers, we will be, like, you know, either literally or figuratively, you know, giving our toys down to our kids. And we will because we will be showing them the movies we love. And, or in some cases, you know, Dave, I'm sure you're going to be, like, giving your kids the toys that you love and you still have. You know, and
been to my desk, haven't you?
I've seen your desk. Yeah, okay. Well, I've seen your house.
Yeah.
So, I think it really did tap into that really well. You know, just the whole thing of like, you know, if you really do love your toys and they do mean so much to you. I mean, I wrote that in my review of the film. There's a toy that my brother gave me when I was 17. It's my family dog. You know, the Tim Burton. Yeah, I have my family dog toy.
Nice.
I've named him Pee-wee, and I've had him since I was 17. I've taken him like with me everywhere I go, and I you know, he still sits on a shelf. And I love the toy, and I've never gotten rid of him. And I don't even know why I love it so much. It's probably because my brother gave it to me. But But on the other hand, like another thing about the movie that I related to, as you related to the film clearly, was a week before I went to Maui, I was going through old boxes and I found these old stuffed animals of like rabbits and puppies and stuff that I had when I was a baby, but I don't remember the names I gave them. I don't have a relationship with them. I didn't feel anything looking at them. And I felt horrible about that because these are toys I used to love and now they're cast away in these boxes. And sure enough, at the end of the day, I actually put them back in a box and put them back up on the shelf, like these forgotten toys that used to mean so much to me when I was an infant. You know, and I think that's one thing this movie's dealing with. I mean, it's kind of using toys as like a metaphor for like, you know, letting go of our childhood, letting go of the things that we love, or, you know, dealing with all these other things. There's a lot going on here. I'll end my diatribe this way. There's something that I wrote in my review of the film, and I showed it to my wife and my father, and they said, you need to get rid of that. But I still kind of wondered about it. For me, the movie had a subplot in which the purple bear character, what was his name again?
Lotso.
Thank you, Lotso, where it seemed like because he had this southern accent, and because there is this, I won't give it away, but he does essentially enslave the characters. I feel like there was kind of a slave colony thing kind of going on there. I insinuated it in my review, and everyone I showed that to said, get rid of that. That has no place
in your... He's the boss hog of Toy Story 3.
That's what I thought, yeah, and I thought it was kind of making a thing about like white sharecroppers and that whole inflating thing of like, either you're with us, wow, you know, or not. Anyway, I ended up getting rid of that because it kind of weighted down my review.
Didn't Ed Beatty, didn't he play like a racist sheriff in some movie or something?
Was it Rosewood, the John Singleton movie? I'm just guessing. I can't remember.
I figured his casting was a bit of a tip of the hat to that, so
okay.
I don't know.
I may be onto something, but either way, I chickened out and took it out of my review.
Let me close this discussion with an interesting question.
Okay.
Do you guys think it was a bit of a risk for Pixar, who makes their living off of geeks for the most part, honestly? I mean, a lot of the word of mouth comes from the geek community, who's essentially built around holding on to those things from your childhood. For them to come across that message essentially saying there's a time to give up childish things, do you think that was a bit of a risky move on their end?
No, not really.
Okay.
I don't know. Because
I think the fact that they handled it so well.
That's the thing. For me, the risk was making Toy Story 3 at all. Mm-hmm. For me, that was, and honestly, when I first heard they were making this, I thought, this is a mistake. You know, you've been hearing me rant about this. The Incredibles 2. That's what we want. That's what the geeks want. But the thing is, even if Toy Story 3 was terrible, kids would still flock to it anyway. That's the fact of the matter. Because, you know, because Pixar has such a great name that for me, it's like, even if it was a bad movie, it would make money anyway, because that's the nature of the beast. But because it's so terrific, for me, that's where the risk paid off. And because the movie, it doesn't play it easy or safe.
No.
The sequence with Chuckles the clown and Lotso and the baby is so surreal and strange and darkly funny, but also so incredibly weird. It's kind of like, this is why Pixar is so great. Character and story first the whole way through. And it may go in ways that you can anticipate, but more often they don't. Yeah. They really do want to take storytelling risks that most mainstream movies never take.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I figured we have a bit to say about it, and I'm glad we did.
Yeah, no, it's a great film. I mean, I think I'm already at the point where I feel like it's a little overrated, but I do love the film, and I will get behind it. But for me, this is not up. This is not a mega, mega masterpiece, and I don't know if I'd see it again in theaters.
Gotcha. So. Okay. Well, speaking of in theaters, let's talk about what came out this past weekend.
Currently, the number two movie in America, and boy, it's number two, an appropriate number for this film, the Adam Sandler ensemble comedy. And, you know, I'll be completely honest, I've not heard, the reviews have been bad, I've not seen it, but everything I've heard about this, it sounds just so bad. I heard Chris Rock is really wasted in this film, grown-ups, of course, I'm talking about. I hear Chris Rock is wasted and Kevin James is wasted. When David Spade gets more screen time and more to do than Chris Rock, that just ticks me off,
That's wrong. That's just wrong.
That's very wrong. A film that Dave and I have talked about, we'll talk about when we both saw the James Mangold, what is it, an action comedy thriller romance, Night and Day, with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. That was it.
Yeah, our friend Nate saw Grown Ups, and he said, essentially, if you want to watch it, just watch the trailer again, and you'll know I say that because the trailer wasn't that good in the first place. So There you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, I didn't. I've heard people say, "Oh, the trailer is so hilarious. The part with the where they're peeing in the pool." To me, this is like everything that Funny People made fun of. That Adam Sandler makes these terrible types of movies. I mean, to me, like Funny People is more and more like on the nose than even before, because he like after Funny People was a total disaster. Even though the critics loved it, audiences hated. Like, boo, we don't like him when he's not funny. So here he's going back to like Merman. You know.
All right, night and day.
Well, you know, I'll get it out of the way. I like the film. I don't think it's a bad film. I don't think it's a great film. I think it's a mess, for starters.
Oh,
I think it's one of the most uneven films of the year.
Yes.
I thought parts of it were great. I thought the action sequences were fun. I thought some of the comic parts worked really well, but for me, no momentum.
It's no, just there's kinda, none. It there's stopped no chemistry, and no momentum, really. I mean, there's one scene where there's some good chemistry going on, but
well, you know, I'll jump to the chase. Like, you know, this movie is trying to be True Lies. It's trying to be Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and you know, and you know, the formula of mixing like violent, state of the art action with romance and comedy. I think what made True Lies and Mr. and Mrs. Smith to a lesser extent work is that at some point the two characters do meet each other halfway. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis becomes the equal of Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, totally,
and then the second hour of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where Brad Pitt and Jolie are a fighting force, and the comedy and everything comes together. I won't give it away, but with Night and Day, when it finally happens, it's way too late.
The movie
is essentially over, and it's a missed opportunity. And you've got Cameron Diaz for about 90% of the movie running around screaming, being a damsel in distress.
Mm-hmm.
This would be perfect if it was a lesser actress trying to get her first showcase role. But Cameron Diaz, you know, I mean, we know she's not only an actress, but a great actress because of John Malkovich and because of like Any Given Sunday. She could hold her own, and we know she's a good action movie star. So casting her in this, like, you know, screaming Mimi role where she's not even on the level of Kathleen Turner in Romance in the Stone was a huge mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Cruise's performance was fine. It was very funny. It was very clever. But the movie didn't deserve it, in a sense. I think Mangold, the story was just
kind of over
the place.
Do you think it was the directing or the writing that was the problem?
I think a little of both. I think tonally the movie was kind of out of whack at times.
Absolutely.
So for me, like, I wouldn't even say guilty pleasure. I think parts of this movie were fun and they really worked, and the parts that clicked really clicked, but this movie needed to be either edited down to 90 minutes or maybe 10 minutes added to make kind of sense of everything, because I felt that it was just such a mess of things.
It is. Oh, man. You know, the opening bit I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Through the plane events, I'll say. And even the parts where you have that first car chase were kind of fun. And then it dragged pretty much for the entire movie for me until she gets given the truth serum. I'll just say that. After that, I thought it picked up steam again.
Yeah.
Like, in a big way, and had a great time. But then it just dropped off like a rock for me again after they used the same freaking drug montage for the 15 millionth time.
Right, right. They really overused that. And there really wasn't much of a payoff to that.
There was none.
Because you know what it did? Like, because it's making the characters feel like, you know, like they're kind of fading in and out of the movie. And that's what it did for us.
Yes.
You know, it's like we're fading in and out from one action scene to another. And, like, after a while, none of it mattered. I love the motorcycle chase scene with the, you know, interspersing with the chasing the bulls. Like, fun individual set pieces. And, you know, it makes the movie fun on a superficial level to watch, but it just, the film leaves nothing for you to chew on afterwards.
Yeah, after that chase was over and you have that, what could have been the, you could call the first ending to the movie.
Yeah.
It killed it for me.
Sure.
I hated everything from then on.
Well, like, the ending was such a nothing ending. I mean, for Pete's sake, I mean, at least if you're going to have one of those open-ended endings where you're clearly trying to set up a franchise, at least give us like some exciting thing to happen. But like,
instead of doing that, they said, okay, the movie's over. And the franchise is over.
Right. You know, I got to say, the title is terrible. Night and Day is a terrible title. Like, even if you know why they call it Night and Day, like, the original title for this movie was Wichita, which is also not an exciting movie title. Like, they really should have, like, come up with a third alternative, because Night and Day is a stupid title, too.
I really think this movie is the sign of how weak the summer's been. Or, okay, maybe not weak, how spoiled we've been in past summers. Because if this movie had come out a summer or two or even three ago, this thing would have gotten buried by every single critic on the face of the earth. And the fact is we've had pretty lackluster movies. I mean, for the past few summers, every week there's been something. I got to see this. I got to see that. When this trailer hit, it was like, that doesn't look like it'll completely suck. And there's nothing else coming out for a couple weeks. So why not? Let's go see it.
I don't know. Because for me, my two favorite movies this summer were basically completely overlooked by audiences and critics. And that was Robin Hood and The A-Team, two movies I adored. So You know, and then Splice, which is not a bad movie, but not a great film.
Again, it's a good first two thirds, and then
yeah. So I think, you know, kind of waiting for the consistently great movie, Inception, perhaps.
Just wait for Inception.
Inception.
I want to see Inception. I want to see The Hole. The Joe Dante flick.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, is that getting released this summer?
I thought so. Maybe not.
I have no idea.
Pushed back. I don't know.
Well, you know what? I even want to see Predators, because if it's dumb fun, I'll take dumb fun. Just like The Expendables, I don't care if it has the greatest plot ever. I mean, if it's thrilling, I'll take thrills.
Exactly. So, okay, let's go ahead and talk about what's hidden. What were you saying, Ethan?
I'm just saying Scott Pilgrim.
That's true. Scott Pilgrim. It's iffy, but it's Edgar Wright. That
trailer makes it look like Speed Racer to me. I think it's going to be terrible. I like Edgar Wright. I like Michael Cera. I like the cast, but it looks terrible to me. If I'm proven wrong, I will eat crow on this show, but I think it looks like a terrible film.
Fair enough. All right. What's hitting DVD this week, sir?
Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief.
Speaking of crap.
I didn't see it. Did you see it?
No, but I've heard from people who have seen it, and they're like, it's a really bad Harry Potter ripoff.
Cody loved it.
Oh, man.
So I feel like I should see
He's borrowing a bunch of movies on mine since he's having his tonsils out. So he's getting schooled in good movies.
Cool. Yes. Good man. Hot Tub Time Machine. I think this is one of these movies that kind of got blown out of proportion. They try to make it into like this event geek movie. And you see the film, I think with lowered expectations, it's a lot of fun and really funny. But it's not quite the event comedy they made it out to be. But I like this film. I thought it was fun.
Still, something I want to bring up. Like this, how much did it make? Like 30, 40 million?
About 40 to 50. I think 50 million.
Is that what Grown Ups is going to make in its like opening weekend alone?
Yeah.
And like they tackle similar like subject matter. It's just like audiences lame. That's what I'm saying.
All right.
I think Grown Ups looks like a sure thing for that sort of movie, which is funny to think that Grown Ups would be considered a sure thing about anything. And you know, Grown Ups made $41 million over the weekend, and I think what was it? I think Funny People made $25 million over the same. And it's funny how like one movie, like Grown Ups, is considered an instant hit, you know, but like Funny People is considered an instant flop, despite the fact that even though it's uneven, Funny People is such a superior movie.
Yeah.
So the perception of like a hit and failure in Hollywood is still so screwed up. A film that made about $45, $50 million. Not a bad movie, but again, lower your expectations. The Crazies. Good film.
I watched that this week, actually.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I thought bringing up Brad Dourif again, but the guy, you know, Joe Anderson, who was like the deputy, I thought he was awesome.
Yes.
Like he was kind of like, he's awesome in Control and Across the Universe, but he's kind of like a bit of a pretty boy in that, but in this movie he was like totally like Brad Dourif-esque. And
right, and he's got that penultimate scene he has, I thought was very strong. Good film, The Crazies. Let's see, Criterion has got a Night Train to Munich with Rex Harrison. I have not seen this, but it looks really cool because it's Criterion. Predator, the Ultimate Hunter Edition on Blu-ray.
I wonder why that's coming out.
Seriously, like if you're a diehard Predator fan, don't you already own this movie?
No, I've heard the Blu-ray is god awful. Like people prefer to own the DTS DVD of it. So this re-release hopefully has been remastered. And for those of you
crap.
Who liked Predator, I hope you get a good release.
I hate hearing about how these Blu-rays are terrible, because Blu-ray was supposed to be like the second coming. And now you're hearing about these bad Blu-ray titles of these great films. That's so disappointing.
Yeah.
When You're Strange, a film about the Doors. Title kind of sums it up. Hope it's good. The Palme d'Or winner for Best Picture last year, Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon. Supposed to be very shocking and challenging. I'm looking forward to seeing that one. Creation. Boy, this is a mixed bag. Creation. Oh, Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly. Not a bad movie. Not a great movie. Like not bold enough to be offensive, but not like strong enough to really make an impact. If anything, it made Darwin look like a total kook. I think both creationists and evolutionists are going to hate the film.
Don't forget Spineless.
Totally spineless. Yeah. And like the stylish scenes in the movie I think those are the things that stayed with me. Like the motion, the time capture scenes of things rotting in the ground. Those have stayed with me, those scenes, more than any of the performances. Jennifer Connelly was wasted in this.
Shrieking Shrew.
This is one of our, like, seriously, if you look at her best work, I would say she's like one of our best, most underrated American actresses, and she's just wasted in this film.
Yeah.
So come to think of it, more of a disappointment than anything.
Don't waste your time.
Yeah, don't waste your time. Uncle Sam, this is one of those video favorites from the 80s and 90s. This is the one where Uncle Sam literally comes and gets you. It's available on Blu-ray. Not sure why, but there it is.
hey, we got Tromeo and Juliet on Blu-ray, so why not this?
Tromeo and Juliet. again, you know, I love Lloyd Kaufman. That movie did not deserve Blu-ray. Mia Kay's new film called Versus. I don't know anything about
it. It's not
about
a new film.
One.
It's one of his older ones.
Okay.
It's just being released on Blu-ray finally.
So. Okay. Do you know what it's about? Is it any good?
I forget.
Okay.
It's Wait, just Mia Kay.
Versus? I've seen that. That's not a Mia Kay. It's the guy who did Midnight. It's the guy who did Midnight Meat Train.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
How did I think? I'm sorry. My bad.
That's okay. Yeah,
it's like it's like a bunch of guys in a forest killing zombies with samurai swords. I know that sounds awesome, but I remember not really liking it. So
okay,
eh. Okay, fair enough.
All right, let's see what else we got. Warehouse 13 season 1,
which I bring that up because I've watched the pilot. I'm not ready to pass judgment, but it's kind of fun so far.
Okay,
it's kind of like Area 51, but kind of zany.
Okay,
I don't know. Get crushed with Eureka, I guess.
And then you get The Leopard, available for the first time on Criterion. You know, it's like, it's one of these Criterion movies I haven't heard of, I haven't seen, but 9 out of 10, I get a Criterion title, I either rent it or buy it or watch it, and 9 out of 10, it ends up being this amazing discovery,
so
I'll probably end up checking out The Leopard at some point. And then finally...
Do you want me to talk about it?
Go ahead.
Our crap title of the week. Wow, yeah, this is a spiffy one. Detective Jacob King is one of the most celebrated homicide detectives in the country. His brutal delivery of street justice is legendary among the men and women of law enforcement. But on his latest case, he may have finally met his match. Lazarus, a cunning and perversely violent killer who is on the loose and terrorizing the inner city. King's desperate pursuit of Lazarus takes him into the dark, depraved Memphis underworld of street sex and senseless violence. That's right, Steven Seagal in Kill Switch. It's Steven Seagal.
Does he do this between Lawman or what?
I'm guessing. Maybe it's just a documentary and they're not really allowed to say it.
You know, I haven't seen a recent Steven Seagal movie in some time. The last movie I saw of his was the last hit he had, which was Exit Wounds. That actually did really well about 10 years ago. But I haven't seen any of his recent ones. There's the one, I can't remember the name of it, went straight to DVD, where it's him versus vampires. I would love to see Steven Seagal versus vampires. I've not seen that one.
That is a new one for sure.
But what I've been told is that, like, the thing that his diehard fans, I'm not a diehard fan, but I'll admit, I liked Steven Seagal movies back in the day. The one thing I've heard consistently is that with every new film, there's so little action in terms of him. Like, he's obviously slower with his older age. I'm not gonna pick on his weight, but apparently, like, he's just doesn't have what he used to have, and there's a lot of doubling for his movie. Yeah, I've heard, like, essentially the thrill is gone with Steven Seagal.
I hear he's dubbed over as well.
Really?
Yeah, because he's like...
So he just, like, he ADRs himself?
No, I think they get, like, other people to do ADR for him.
Wow. Well, I do need to give the guy a fair shake and look at one of his straight-to-DVD movies, just out of morbid curiosity, but...
There you go.
Yeah, it's a shame. Well, one of the premier action stars of the 90s, what's happened to his career? It's a shame. It's a real shame. Yeah. I keep Law hoping JCVD
is
his
Man's a
way.
Good show, though.
Is it? I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Well, it's good.
Well, it's cops with Steven Seagal, right?
Yeah, yeah, and you follow him around. It's pretty entertaining.
Cool. There's nothing wrong with that. Cool. All right, let's go ahead and move on to some news. Barry, why don't you get yours out of the way, sir, first?
Well, my first two I stole right off of the Ed and Greg show because they were just so good. It's really happening. This is one of these things that hit the news, and it sounds like, oh, that's just silly. No, this is really, really happening. On the Sci-Fi Network, you've got Megapython versus Gatoroid. I'll say that again. Megapython versus Gatoroid.
That's really not the best part. It's which two actors are going to be pitted against each other.
Actresses in quotations.
Musicians from the
90s. Formerly Debbie Gibson, now Deborah Gibson, because, you know, that's legit. She's a Broadway actress. Deborah Gibson and Tiffany, who still goes by just Tiffany.
From the Jetsons movie.
And from Playboy. Okay, they actually fight each other. Like, apparently in this movie, it's a fight that begins in a bar and it proceeds like into the jungle, and it's a total all-out catfight fist fight between two of the biggest pop stars of the 80s. So this movie, even without the Megapython and the Gatoroid, which is either, you know, a crocodile with a hemorrhoid or a robot android gator, this movie has Tiffany and Deborah Gibson, like, beating the living crap out of each other.
You know, I don't think you go wrong with either of those descriptions of
So Gatorade. I think this is going to be a ratings bonanza for sci-fi.
Or it was a typo, and it's actually Gatorade.
Gatorade. There you go. Product placements in the title.
Yeah, yeah. All right, what else have you got, sir?
And then David S. Ward, the writer-director of the Major League films, insists that there will be a Major League 4. And Major League 4 will star Tom Berenger, Corbin Burnson, and... Charlie Sheen. They're coming back. But this is the wild thing. He even thinks he can get Wesley Snipes back, Because, you know, of course, Wesley Snipes is Willie
Mays. What
else
is he doing?
Willie Mays Hayes in the first one. Yeah, because, you know, of course, Wesley Snipes was not in the second one. He was replaced by Omar Epps. But, yeah, apparently the gang will be back together in the fourth movie.
Wow.
So, do you remember Major League?
Not really. I vaguely remember the every time they win a game.
They peel off a section. Yeah, that's the only part I remember, too. It's not a good movie.
Between Charlie Sheen and Wesley Snipes, how much, like, legal trouble is there?
That's true. They're going to be wearing their, like, their ankle bracelets, like, during the movie.
Every once in a while, I hear a little beep over the boom mics. Yeah,
I have to digitally erase that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we don't need a Major League 4, but, you know, just to see them back, it's kind of like that Universal Soldier regeneration movie. I want to see just because they're in it. So
Fair enough. Ethan, why don't you go next, sir?
A few trailers here. This trailer came out last week, but we're talking about it this week. The trailer for Sofia Coppola's Somewhere, starring my man, Stephen Dorff.
It looks good.
Very intriguing.
You have no idea what it's about.
Well, I mean, it looks like a Hollywood guy who has to raise his daughter in the midst of all his artistic work and his wild ways. There have been movies like this. I immediately think of like James Earl Brooks' movie "I'll Do Anything," and there was another one.
I was going to say The Game Plan, but
yeah, The Game Plan. Well, I think it's safe to say this will be better than both of those movies. Yeah, you know, it's Sofia Coppola. It's funny that in the trailer, you know,
it has a very Lost in Translation feel to it.
Well, you know, it says the writer director Lost in Translation. Love it. They don't mention Marie Antoinette because then people would be like, no. But yeah, Somewhere looked very good.
I think this could be like Stephen Dorff's The Wrestler, to be honest.
I would love for that to be the case because you know what? He is such an underrated actor. It's a shame that most people know him as the bad guy in Blade. But if you look at his filmography, I mean, he's taken a lot of choices and a lot of them have been really risky and really crazy. I really admire this guy. So, I would love for this to be his Wrestler. Yeah. And I like that it's Elle Fanning and not Chloe Moretz. I'm like, I'm kind of done with her. But yeah, I'm glad it's Elle
Fanning.
She's
in two movies.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay.
And she was in 500 Days of Summer.
Was she?
Yeah, she was the annoying little sister character that was terrible.
Wow, okay.
Remember?
Huh. All right, then.
She was. Well, I guess you didn't like Kick-Ass, but...
No, I didn't like Kick-Ass.
I thought she was the best part of that, but, yeah. Actually, I was just going to say, it'd be funny if Elle Fanning, she got, like, an Oscar nomination for this. She'd be the first Fanning sister to be nominated.
Oh,
can you imagine,
man.
Dakota?
It would, like, turn into, like, whatever happened to Baby Jane at that house, man. Those two Fanning sisters would just down.
Hey, Dakota can be up for an MTV Movie Award for Twilight.
Oh, you're right. So, ooh. See, it is even Steven in the Fanning
totally.
Household.
It's all good.
Next trailer, the trailer for The Green Hornet came out. What you guys think of this one?
I was so disappointed.
Yeah.
I hate that it's a modern-day film and that it's about two guys. Like, we need to do something with their lives. Let's be The Green Hornet and Kato. I was let down. And I never would have guessed it was a Michel Gondry movie from the trailer. And I was completely let down. My expectations couldn't be more rock bottom at this point.
I didn't think it was awful, but it was eh.
I don't think this trailer is actually an accurate representation of the movie, to be honest.
I don't think they can, if it's going to be a true Gondry film.
Yeah, like I can just tell by like the hip hop and all that stuff that they're just like, they probably have this really weird movie on their hands and they're like, okay, let's make this look as typical as possible. So. And I know people have complained about Seth Rogen in the trailer. The thing is, I think that's part of the thing, because they are trying to make it look like a typical superhero movie. But the thing is, I would like the idea of seeing, like, Seth Rogen in a superhero movie, you know? Because it doesn't matter anyway. In 5 years, you'll get the reboot starring Channing Tatum and Jet Li. So it's like, for now, we have our kind of goofy Green Hornet, and I'm interested in seeing that.
Okay.
But, yeah, the trailer, I don't know.
It's
definitely
underwhelming.
But.
For me, it looks more Pineapple Express than anything. I was so let down by this.
Dang.
I can't even express how disappointed I was. I'd love to be wrong, but for me, it looks like a sellout job on Gondry's part. There, I said it.
Dang, especially since he was like slated to work on it like 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm. Yeah.
Okay.
So January comes wrong. If I'm wrong, I would be so happy about that. But yeah, that trailer. Just like, no, this is exactly what I didn't want.
Fair enough. All right, sir, what you got next?
The teaser trailer for David Fincher's The Social Network came out.
Now, this is exactly what I wanted. This looked exactly what I wanted. It looks just like the book. It looks just exactly how they're treating it. I don't know. I just, the timing couldn't be more perfect for this movie. This is, you know, we're currently like, I mean, Facebook is still one of the most talked about, one of the most relied upon things people turn to whenever they turn on a computer. The timing for this movie is going to be perfect. It looks like it's going to be fun and funny. It looks like. We didn't see anything. Just tonally, just from the tone, this is exactly the movie I hoped it would be.
It's interesting you bring that up, because actually the tone I got from this trailer was a very kind of ominous and dark feel. Like I'm glad this trailer to me is really like selling this as a drama, mm-hmm. with like heavy, you know, consequences and repercussions, which I'm excited to see, because it seems like whenever this movie is brought up, people like they just think it's like literally a Facebook movie. It's like, no, this is a drama about, you know, people selling each other out and stuff. So.
What would a Facebook movie be? Like, if 5 minutes in the movie, people meet each other, ignore. I mean, like, how do you...
It's a South Park episode.
Yeah, I mean, how do you make a... I don't know. I don't think people even know what to expect from this film.
Well, yeah, just because people are dumb. So they're like these internet fanboys, like, Facebook movie with Justin Timberlake. Nah. But, you know, it's a good Conan impression, right? It's a movie written by Aaron Sorkin, for Christ's sakes. You know, yeah. It's like.
Well done on the Conan impression there.
It's clearly going to demonize Zuckerberg. And you know what? I like that one of the most successful, snarky guys who like stepped on everybody he knew to climb up the corporate ladder, a guy who represents everything that's currently wrong with American corporate society, that whole dog-eat-dog thing that started in the 80s and continues to thrive. I love this movie's attacking that, because let's face it, we tend to celebrate jerks like that. So,
well, the best thing is, you know, like you said, this is very timely. If they'd been making a MySpace movie...
That would be very different. Yeah, a MySpace movie.
You know, about the origins of MySpace. Who cares?
Origins of MySpace are not as interesting. Honestly, everything is in Accidental Billionaires. That book, they deal with all this stuff, okay. all the social network sites. But no, I think this is going to be engrossing. If it's as good as the book, this is going to be one of the best films of the year.
I can't wait.
I really hope, though, there's a full trailer out soon, because I'm really just interested to see, like, visually what Fincher would do with this. But, you know.
I wouldn't be surprised if they waited for Comic-Con to really unveil this, but yeah.
We'll see. Is it really a Comic-Con movie, though?
That's going to be my question.
Well, you know, I think they're going to cater to the geek crowd, because this movie is about them. It's about how people like them could be very successful, but it's about how they can also lose their souls if they get caught up in the machines and caught up in their own ego, because it is about an ego gone amok, and how Justin Timberlake's character really does essentially feed into that ego. Justin Timberlake, if he pulls it off, I mean, this could be the one that really puts him on the map as an actor, you know, in the way Alpha Dog and all the other ones didn't. Yeah, and what's his name? Eisenberg.
Yeah.
Eisenberg has a really challenging role here. If he pulls it off, it could be Oscar time, because that character is fascinating, and if he brings it, it's going to be incredible. Can't wait.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Sorry.
You got anything else, sir?
Oh, one last thing. Apparently the rights to The Catcher in the Rye might be sold, and we may finally see a movie version of it.
This is one of those things I just don't know how well it would translate to film.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like this is almost like Pandora's box. It's like, how badly do we want this? And once it's out there, are we really going to like want to keep this? Because Catcher in the Rye, I mean, this is one of the 10 greatest books ever written. I don't know if Salinger's book really was ever meant to be made into a film. In fact, I would say it's unfilmable. And I mean that as a compliment. I just don't know if this is going to work. It's just like the Kerouac On the Road movie they've been talking about for years. If you read On the Road is meant to be read. I really don't know if it's going to be it's because it's not going to work as a road movie or an action movie or a drama. It's not The Motorcycle Diaries. This is an internalized story. So is Catcher in the Rye. I mean, you're going to have a bunch of fantasy sequences and flashbacks within flashbacks. Catcher in the Rye, I mean, Halton Caulfield, he's something, you're meant to experience this character in your mind and, you know, personally, internally. It's not, you know, I don't think it would work as, you know, Zac Efron as Halton Caulfield, you know. And I worry about that, unless you have a director who is frickin' brilliant. I mean, off the charts brilliant. doing this. I mean, it can't be middle of the road.
I can kind of see it as like a Noah Baumbach movie, to be honest.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's an excellent choice. I was thinking someone like him or Spike Jonze. I mean, it has to be somebody who is just effing brilliant. We can't have middle of the road. I mean, no offense to Mr. Ratner, but like if someone like Brett Ratner or anybody like in those lines, anybody who's had like a $100 million hit in the last 20 years, it's going to fail. We need somebody who is dangerous. We need somebody who is going to just bring crazy creativity to this. Gilliam. Even if Gilliam made a mess of it, I would rather it be made like an artistic, creative mess than someone who plays it safe and does like a literal translation, because literal is going to kill this.
Zack Snyder.
You mean the visionary director of 300?
The visionary director of Legend of the Guardians, the Owls of...
Oh, wow.
Every time I see that trailer, like...
You can't take it seriously.
It looks so asinine. I can't believe they spent over $100 million on that.
I think it looks like a hoot.
Oh. Well played, sir.
Well, you know, I'm glad you said it first, Ethan, because I'm sure by the time it comes out, that's all we're going to hear. So.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Wow. It's the first time I've heard it said about that.
Do we want to talk about the Red trailer?
I guess we can ever so briefly, yeah. Apparently this is based off a comic property from DC.
Yeah, I never heard of it.
It's
like Wanted. Like, really? It's a comic?
Yeah, but it kind of does remind me of Wanted, but better quality is probably the best way I can put it, I guess. It looks more fun, for sure.
Well, Wanted looked like fun, too, until you saw the movie, but I don't know about this. I mean, Helen Mirren being remade as like a mainstream star is so weird to me.
As an action star with machine guns off the back of a truck, and yeah.
Well, like, look, I mean, if she's having fun, good for her, and she deserves it because she's put in her time. But like, you know, going from the Queen to National Treasure, Book of Secrets to
it's kind of the Ben Kingsley route.
This is not a step up for one of the greatest actresses of the last 15 years. I mean, she's a brilliant, brilliant actress. She's capable of so much more. I mean, if they're having fun, good. But is this going to be worth their time? I don't know.
Yeah. It's Bruce Willis. Who else was in it?
Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
And Mary Louise Parker. Yeah, so great cast. I don't recognize the director, in all fairness, so I don't know if this is going to be a good thing.
It looks like it could be fun, but it also... honestly, I got burned by Night and Day. Almost every single good part of that movie was in the trailer. And I'm like... this could be the same thing.
Was it? Because I only saw the teaser trailer, and they didn't show any of the motorcycles.
That last segment of it, where they're with the truth serum on through the motorcycle, but they didn't show. But every other part that was halfway decent was in the trailer.
Okay, because I just saw the teaser trailer. It just showed the airplane scene. That's really it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Obviously, my expectations are a little higher anyway.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so Red. I don't know. Yeah, for me, it's like it's one of those kind of on thin line things. Like it could go either way, but it... yeah, expectations are...
looks better than salt that's been getting crammed down my throat every time I go to the theater.
I love the director so much. I'm going to give that a shot. Philip Noyce. I love Philip Noyce. When he makes a great movie, it's like off the charts great. So I'm hoping Salt's going to be pretty incredible.
Okay. Yeah. The trailer's annoying me more than anything else.
It looks familiar, you know, and you know, I think
it looks bland familiar.
It would be even more familiar looking if Tom Cruise were the star, but because it's Jolie who actually can act... Cruise can act too. Excuse me. I don't want to slam Cruise. I love Tom Cruise, but I don't know. I think it looks more interesting with a female lead, and it doesn't look like Tomb Raider to me. I think they are trying to do something better.
Fair enough.
We'll see.
Fair enough. All right. Let me crank through my news since we're over an hour already. Haha.
I got one more. Burton is definitely going to make a stop motion animation Adam's Family movie based on the Chester Gould comics.
That's going to be very interesting.
It's interesting. It's also an obvious choice.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that Dark Shadows movie he's going to make with Johnny Depp. It's like, well, of course he's going to make it. Like, where's Ed Wood? Where's Big Fish? You know, I'm ready for him to do, like, one of those, oh, God, Tim Burton did this.
Yeah.
That's all.
I guess Helena Bonham Keller will be voicing someone in it.
Probably.
Yeah, probably Morticia. Of course.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm sorry, Dave. What do you got?
That's okay. No, it's okay. Hey, you know, my news, mostly the first one's not going to be a shock to everyone, and the news is going to go steadily downhill after that. Actually, no, I'll start with the good news, the interesting news. Marvel talking about possibly doing a short film route for their lesser-known characters, essentially not committing, you know, a big budget to Jonah Hex. Instead, we're going to do a 10-minute short film and see how audiences react.
Jonah Hex.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, it's relative to an extent. It is. It's still going to be an expensive process to put together a short film.
Some of these characters don't deserve full length movies because they're smaller characters with, you know, they don't have the legacy for one, and for a second, they don't need this huge, huge state of the art production. Some characters do deserve a smaller route, and I think this is a good idea.
Like Ant-Man. I love Edgar Wright, you know, but it that would fit that a lot better, I
sure.
think.
Sure.
Along with other characters. I can't even think who else you'd... But they'll yeah, I mean, next R-rated Marvel film, you could do a Deadpool short if you wanted to or something, but it'd have to be an R-rated film.
Well, I know how badly you want a real Deadpool movie, so...
But it's not going to happen. I don't think. I don't think the studio's going to let it happen. But that's just me, especially with Disney doing it. Yeah, okay. But a lot of the B-teamers, I think this is a good way to introduce people to the Marvel universe. So, yeah. In the shocking news that nobody expected, apparently Peter Jackson is in talks to direct The Hobbit.
Well, you know, at least it's not official though, right?
No, they're in talks.
It feels like he's been in talks to do this for a long time. Even when Del Toro was attached, I still suspected something like this would happen.
Yeah.
So I'm ready for it to be made official. And Jackson, just do it. Just do it. Just get it and move on.
Well, the problem is, are they going to be able to get the money together since MGM's holding the bag on this and they have nothing to put anything into anything?
What's the deal with MGM? I thought they were like bought by like Sony and they were doing okay. I thought basically Sony was releasing their movies.
Yeah, now all of a sudden like there's no bond. Like what's going on over there?
Apparently, I think it was Sony who put in a bid of like $1.5 billion to buy it. But the MGM creditors weren't happy with that because they owe so much money.
Man.
So $1 billion, $1.5, I forget how much it was, but they are like in debt to like $4 billion or something like that.
What if they just fold and sell the rights to all your movies?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what if they did halvesies? You know, what if it was like, you know, MGM and Warner Brothers? You know, Warner Brothers would get behind it. Like, what if they just split the cost with another studio? I mean, yeah, they'd have to like split the grosses, but you're still talking like, even if it sucks, there's still going to be like $300 million each for the studios.
Yeah. Plus the DVD, Blu-ray rights. Plus
Right. They're going to make a fortune no matter what. Even if it's terrible, it's The Hobbit. It's going to do a fortune. So they might as well split it with another studio if they can't afford it.
Yeah,
who knows? So MGM will pay for like the catering and the other studio will pay for everything else.
Well, the movie that I'm really interested, I'm bummed on, I'm hoping it gets released, is Cabin in the Woods. That's an MGM film.
What the heck happened with that?
It's been pushed back to January.
Because I heard they were going to convert it to 3D, right?
They were pushing for it. I heard an interview with Lisa Lasik, the editor, and they're fighting it as hard as they can.
Man.
Because they don't think it'll work in 3D.
When did they film this? Feels like it was made forever
ago. It was filmed a while ago, yeah. But they've had test screenings, and people have loved it, so.
Okay, because it feels like the Lucky McGee movie, The Woods, you know, which I liked. Yeah. And that thing got, like, it got stuck in release limbo, and then it never got released theatrically, and I like The Woods.
Yeah. Okay, time to go to the ever-digressing, regressing crappy news. Let's start off with Timothy Olyphant being discussed as the next Snake Plissken.
No. Gerard Butler made more sense. No, that's just stupid. Oliphant is not an action movie star. Hitman, do we lose Ethan?
I don't know. Let's find out.
You there, buddy?
Yes, we did. We lost him.
Oh, son of a gun.
Are you still there, Ethan? No, you're gone. All right. Oh. We're going to keep recording.
It sounded like he jumped into like a pool or something.
Yeah.
He was so angry he needed to cool off from the Snake Plissken story.
Exactly. So do you think he could pull this off, Ethan?
Well, wasn't Gerard Depardieu going to do it for a while? But then they de-old into French?
Something like that, yes. So they decided to go, I don't know. See, I've heard that Oliphant's good in The Crazies and on Deadwood.
He's great in Deadwood. Yes. He was fine in The Crazies, but he's not an action star. I just want this to not happen, period, to tell you the truth.
We want to see Escape from Earth, I know.
I want to see Escape from Earth. Russell can still do it. He can still do it. Russell is still around. He and Carpenter would be happy to do it. Let him do it.
Exactly. I honestly, okay, so I haven't seen him in either of those two things, The Crazies or Deadwood, but
you've seen Hitman. I mean,
yes,
you know,
he looks like Kurt Russell could make him piss his pants just by looking at him.
Seriously, I mean, in Live Free or Die Hard, I mean, that's, you know, he wasn't bad in that film, but let's face it, I mean, he was not John McClane's equal.
No.
I kind of liked him in The Girl Next Door, but that's like a totally... Yeah, different role.
That makes it perfect for Escape from New York. Oh, yeah, I don't see... You just don't F with a classic.
Don't mess with that one. That's too good.
Yeah.
Well, you say Carpenter and Russell, but the thing is, they probably wouldn't do a $100 million PG-13 3 reboot with a soundtrack by Black John Mayer, produced by T-Pain, so...
Yeah.
Maybe we should just let the series die. I don't know. Let a great series, you know, a fun couple movies.
For me, Escape from LA was I thought it was a terrific movie. I say walk away a winner. Don't go back.
Yeah.
Thank you, Barry. I thought Jay Chill from Film Junk and Kurt Russell's mom were the only three people on Earth who like us. So
I love Escape from LA.
I saw the day it opened for showing of the day, and I got to say, I just walked out buzzing. I absolutely freaking loved it. I've loved the Snake Plissken Chronicles, the comic book series that came out. Yeah, that Russell and Deborah Hill and Carpenter collaborated on. They didn't directly write it, but they helped develop it and the stories, and they gave the approval of everything. And I thought that was a really terrific story that was completely in line. I mean, if you want to see Escape from New York 3, then just read the comic book. Because for me, it was that. It did fill that need that I've had for it.
Indeed. All right. Well, there's a pretty significant drop off even from that. And that would be that we're getting a little Good Luck Trolls doll movie, apparently.
Did the scene from Toy Story 3 go over that big that they felt there needs to be a troll doll movie?
I don't know.
What do you call it? Troll dolls.
I guess.
With a Z.
With a Z. That was the rebooted cartoon from the 90s, I guess, that failed miserably. I just don't see this as any kind of.
Smurfs looked terrible.
Oh, we didn't talk about the Smurfs.
Why
Smurf,
would we?
The Smurf of the Smurfing Smurf. There we go.
Did you see the pictures of
Hank Azaria's guard
in character? My gosh, this
he looks
so
perfect. You gotta admit.
Well, it looks perfect, but it looks terrible. It looks terrible.
Did you watch the Smurfs at
Marty,
all?
Marty, who said DeVito should have played Gargamel.
Yes, I totally agree. He wouldn't even need that much makeup, come to think of it.
But the fact that they did that to Wild Thing, to the song Wild Thing, that they actually, like, defiled that song with the Smurf theme.
They're doing to the Smurfs what they did to Garfield. And it looks, amazingly, it looks worse than Garfield.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, all right. And, yeah, hey, folks, it gets even worse, believe it or not. You know, I think I'm going to switch it up, because I think that Plan 9 is not the worst news of the week. Plan 9 from Outer Space apparently having its colorized print put into 3D conversion.
This is direct to DVD, right?
I know they were talking about doing a theatrical release, like a Fathom Events type thing.
Where did you hear this news?
It was on Ain't It Cool.
It still sounds like something from the amazing Criswell. Like why? This is nuts. This is insanity.
Almost as insane as the next story.
Which is? Just say it.
I can't believe it. We may be getting a Manos the Hands of Fate sequel.
A sequel to Manos from the original cast and crew?
Yes, from the original cast coming back.
I guess they got nothing else going on. Oh,
I guess Torgo goes hanging out around Comic-Con.
Wouldn't you said the cast of the original Manos would be back, right? Would they not be dead?
You'd think.
My recollection of Manos, the Hands of Fate, is admittedly a little hazy. Does it end with the cast dying?
I can't say if I remember if they all lived or not, but I guess I'll have to rewatch it.
Do you really need to?
Well, MST3K.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Any excuse to watch MST3K is worth it.
But yeah, apparently Torgo goes hanging out around Comic-Con. Apparently the Master is going to be with him this year. Yeah, and everyone's up for it, apparently.
Well, I'm sure they are.
What else are they doing?
Doing another movie, of course.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Yeah. So that's the end of the crappy news of the week. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about Barry's adventures at the Maui Film Festival.
Sue Ellen Greenblatt is a real person, not an internet celebrity. So we've enlisted Billy Flynn and the Vicar to help her tell her story.
Geek Radio Daily gives me geeky news about movies, new DVD releases, even comics and gaming.
Geek Radio Daily makes me feel special.
Ah, yeah.
Womanly.
Yeah.
Okay, so the episodes are just 15 minutes, perfect for my commute or for just geeking out while I'm at the office.
Mm. All in one concise love package.
Ooh, the package, baby.
Uh-huh. And the best part is that it's a daily cast, so I'm always in the loop.
Sometimes I listen to it out of the bath, put on little outfits.
Ah!
It makes me want to invite all my friends over to show how refreshed I feel.
Mm, a slumber party, baby.
What? That's not what I said.
Get out the
chocolate mousse.
Duct tape.
Oh, get out of here, you freaks.
Geek Radio Daily. One 15-minute podcast provides 15% of the USDA recommended daily allowance of geeky goodness. Subscribe through iTunes or visit geekradiodaily.com.
And we are back with more fun. Wow, this is a long episode. We've got some catching up to do. But I thought we'd set aside some time so Barry could talk about his grand adventures at the Maui Film Festival.
Thank you, and I promise I won't make this too long-winded because it already is a long episode. But yeah, I did attend the Maui Film Festival this year. This is the 11th annual Maui Film Festival. What is it exactly? What they usually do, it's spread between two locations, the Castle Theater, the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, also called the MAC. So it's the Castle Theater. It literally looks like a castle by the sea in some senses. And they've got a really, really terrific, really beautiful theater with all sorts of balcony seating and whatnot, real classical way to see movies. And then you've got the Celestial Cinema, the other location, which is at the Wailea Golf Resort. And basically what it literally is, you go to this golf
course.
That
looks awesome.
It's literally this golf course that's like out in the middle of the outdoor field. And they erect this huge screen. It is a huge, huge screen, wraparound screen. And they've got speakers all over the golf course, and you watch the movie under the stars, outdoors. It's like going to a drive-in movie without your cars. And considering the atmosphere, it's kind of like Woodstock without music, but just movies, movies, movies. And they occasionally have like stars and celebrities and directors come up and introduce the film before they start. Over the years, movies like Whale Rider and My Big Fat Greek Wedding have had premieres here. Stuff like Happy Endings and... The Great Buck Howard also premiered there. And a lot of these movies, they're not going to get released for at least a year. It's really great. Like, a lot of these movies don't even have trailers up on YouTube. So it's like, it's a real treat to see these films. And in some cases, they're like in a working print kind of state. So what I like to do is work. I like to work the Maui Film Festival. You can go and volunteer and volunteer your time, and depending on how many hours you put in, you get free tickets to see the films, which is really nice because the tickets can be pricey. It's $10 a person to see a film at the Castle Theater. It's $20 to see it at the outside Celestial Cinema. And considering not all the movies are, some of the movies are genuinely bad, you definitely want to get those free tickets so you're not spending $20 to see a stinker. But I'll mention my volunteer time there because that the first night there was when I got to briefly meet Malin Ackerman. That was nuts because she's the only person, big celebrity there who I really wanted to meet. I thought it'd be cool just to like talk to her, just like introduce myself with her. And what ended up happening instead, which was so bizarre, was I'm working at the ticket booth. I'm helping give tickets and whatnot. And I see this figure coming down this dark hallway, and she's wearing a black evening gown. So like I see like a silhouette. She comes out, and she literally like materializes out of the darkness. It was like the craziest thing. And she comes right up to me, and she's telling me this story about like she's trying to find her cab, and she and her husband were looking for her cab, and her cab didn't show up. And I basically told her I didn't know where her cab was.
All right.
That was our conversation. That's my talk with Malin Ackerman.
So Julia got to meet her more than you did.
Julia had a weirder experience where she was in line to the porta potties with Malin Ackerman. And the whole time and Malin Ackerman was standing right in front of her. And Julia didn't know it was Malin Ackerman. And she was about to compliment her on her dress. And then she's like, oh my God, it's Malin Ackerman. So Malin Ackerman goes into this nasty porta potty with this gorgeous evening dress. Her husband, who's kind of a rocker guy and like really protective of his wife, he's like covered in tattoos, kind of an edgy guy. The poor guy like didn't know where to go. So Julia helped him find a porta potty. So that's our experience with the Ackermans, as
wow,
it were.
There
yeah.
It is.
So yeah, real exciting scoop, you know. Anyway, so I'll talk about the movies. Forgive me. All right. So opening night.
That's why you volunteer at a festival, because you never know when you're going to have something.
You never
like that
know.
Happen.
And I got to say, Maui Film Festival is so laid back. I mean, the audience attending these movies, it's usually a lot of tourists, but you also get local audiences who are there for the surf movies and for the reggae documentaries and the surf documentaries. And then you've got serious movie buff film lovers. And then you get these crazy, wild eyed hippies, some of which have been living on the beach. I don't know how they got tickets. Or these guys living in Paia who are just like crazy burnouts from the 60s and total deadheads who have Jerry Garcia stories. So it's a little bit of everything and everybody at the film festival. It's a lot of fun. The people running the festival couldn't be nicer. It's so laid back. I mean, you're just kind of walking, bumping into celebrities, and it's the coolest. It's the greatest, greatest film festival. It's even more laid back than a Denver film festival, if that's possible. Damn. Anyway, the movies. Opening night, and I'll mention the movies of merit, because there's a lot of films, but the ones that are worth mentioning. I didn't see this one. My friend Shay did. He loved it. I've heard a lot of good things about this. There's an Australian musical comedy called Brand New Day. It stars Jeffrey Rush. The title is spelled Bran, brand new, N-U-E, day, D-A-E, brand new day. It's a musical, and it's supposed to be just terrific. That was the opening night film. Also opening night, they show the film Home, which is supposed to be this documentary about Earth. I heard one guy walk out of it shaking his head, saying, oh, another frickin' Al Gore movie. So there you go. That's what that film is that was the perception of that film. Castles in the Sky, I don't know if that's ever going to come to the mainland. Definitely kind of a Maui film. A documentary about surfing, supposed to be really, really good. A movie I've heard terrific things about, a documentary called Rocksteady, The Roots of Reggae. Exactly what it sounds like. It's about the origins of reggae music, supposed to be really, really good. Let's see. The following night, they had Nowhere Boy. This is, of course, the film about John Lennon's early years. Looks pretty good. Also, it stars Kristen Scott Thomas, among other people. The early reviews, and I should say this really quick, a lot of these films premiered previously at the Sundance Film Festival. A lot of the early word for Nowhere Boy is that it's a good film, not a great movie, not one of the definitive movies about John Lennon, but still good. They also show the film Norman with Adam Goldberg, supposed to be good. The one that sounds really intriguing that I unfortunately did not get the chance to see, the film The Freebie. This stars Dax Shepard, Dax Shepard from Employee of the Month, among other...
Or One in Rome.
One in Rome, Idiocracy. The Freebie looks really intriguing. It's about this couple. They're laying in bed one night just talking, and they decide, you know, they've been married for like 7 or so years, and they decide, hey, let's, for one night, let's give each other total freedom to have as many partners as we want and come back. So it's like one night of complete and total freedom, and will their marriage survive it? It's called The Freebie, and apparently it's really, really daring and really delicate, very erotic. I didn't get to see it because it was showing at 11:45 p.m., but apparently people went and really enjoyed it. The following night, two critically acclaimed films, the documentary The Tillman Story. This is about NFL player Pat Tillman, who went to fight in Afghanistan. Yeah, okay. It's supposed to be a terrific film. A movie the trailer just came out for, Melanie Laurent in The Concert. This is a French film, supposed to be absolutely terrific. Didn't see that one. And then finally, another movie I didn't see, but this sounds really wild. The reviews for it have been terrible, but doesn't this sound intriguing? Mark Ruffalo directed a film that he also stars in called Sympathy for Delicious. Sympathy for Delicious. It is about a wheelchair-bound faith healer. It also stars Orlando Bloom and Juliette Lewis.
Interesting.
So, okay. Yeah, the word has not been good on it, but it sounded really intriguing. I didn't see it because I went and saw this. I went and saw the first film directed by Josh Radnor. He's one of the stars of How I Met Your Mother. I actually got to meet him. Really nice guy. Terrific, terrific guy. He wrote and directed this film called Happy Thank You More Please. Happy Thank You More Please premiered at Sundance. Got really good reviews. Good film. It stars Malin Ackerman. That's the reason she was there. Malin Ackerman is completely unrecognizable. It is a multi-character ensemble comedy taking place in New York. Ackerman's character, she has this rare disease where she has no hair. She is unrecognizable the first time you see her. And her work is, it's definitely a character performance. And I got to say, I was very impressed. I'm glad, of all the things I thought I would say to Malin Ackerman when I met her, one thing I knew I never would say was, you were my favorite actress, because I don't like her as an actress. I've never been overly impressed with her until this movie. She is so impressive and so good in this movie. I think I would love to see her play more roles like this. It was a real surprise to see her taking that role. A lot of really great character actors in this movie. Tony Hale, one of the weird brothers in Arrested Development, he's great in the film. Ratner himself is very good in the movie. Richard Jenkins is in it. Happy Thank You More Please. Really, really good movie. Look forward to seeing that one again. Also caught a really bad film, and I feel bad like bashing a movie playing at the Maui Film Festival because of how I feel about the festival. But frankly, this is a movie that I think will go straight to DVD. I hope. It's so terrible. May it never play in a theater in New York, called Cherry. Cherry is a teen sex comedy about a young man's first year experiences in college. It's like a tamer, unfunny, unmemorable version of like American Pie crossed with like The Graduate. It's so, so bad. Ooh. The only actor in it I recognized was Isai Morales. Of course, he was Richie Valens' brother in La Bamba. Isai Morales is a good actor. I don't know why he was in this movie. Just terrible, terrible film. Awful, awful.
Dang.
I should mention this one other film, though, that I played at the film festival, a short film. Although it's so long, I don't know why I'd call it a short film, called God of Love. It's a short movie in black and white about a Venus-like character and basically what his life is like, shooting people with arrows and why he never shoots himself with an arrow. It's in black and white. It is quite brilliant. It's absolutely wonderful. Won a number of audience awards. Hopefully it'll be available streaming somewhere online. So yeah, God of Love. Look for it. It's really good. And finally, the film I did see, and it was closing night of the film festival, and I love this film, and that's, of course, Cyrus from the Duplass Brothers. I can't even tell you, this is one of the best films of the year. This movie defies every expectation you could have going in. Even if you've seen the trailer, I was not expecting how smart this movie is. It avoids every single opportunity to be predictable, to be cheap, to go for easy jokes, to go for crude sexual or bathroom scatological humor. And I'm not saying those things are terrible and that I'm this big snobby film critic who doesn't like those things, although there might be some truth to that. But Cyrus avoids being Step Brothers, frankly. And it has every opportunity to be Step Brothers and avoids it. John C. Reilly, he's played this kind of role before, but never this good. And he is just incredible in this film. Jonah Hill actually plays a real character. He's not playing a variation on his own personality. And Jonah Hill is exceptional. Marissa Tomei makes her character totally believable. The three of them are excellent. I love this movie. I saw it with a packed audience, and they were just laughing hysterically, and I was one of those people. This is going to be a huge breakout hit, I think. I could see this thing playing all summer long, and this is one of the great summer movies of the year, one of the great independent films of the year, and what a great way to end the festival on a high note. So definitely see Cyrus. It is an exceptional film. And I guess I should say a quick thank you to Keith Ranney, who ran the volunteer portion of the festival. Really, really sweet guy. I've known him for a few years. Awesome guy. A pleasure to work for. My friend Jasmine, cab driver, who also helped work with the volunteer people. Excellent people. The different Barrys, all these guys named Barry running the show. Barry Rivers. It's funny. Like, I met people like, oh, you're one of the Barrys, right? No, I'm the other Barry. But Barry Rivers, really cool guy. Really great job everybody did. DJ Get, my friend Get Bryant, who did an awesome job. Providing some excellent sounds of last night there. No, Maui Film Festival is a fantastic, fantastic film festival. It's my favorite film festival in the world. It's one of the most laid back. It's also one of the most engrossing and most memorable. And if nothing else, even when the movies are lacking, just being there is so fantastic. I'm not even just talking about being on Maui, but being there watching a movie under the stars with like this gorgeous beach setting just right behind you, it is really magical and amazing. And I hope everybody who loves film festivals and loves film gets a chance to experience it in their lifetime.
And if you want to see a picture of what Barry's talking about, if you go to MauiFilmFestival.com, which we'll link to on the main page when we post it.
Thank you.
It looks pretty stinking cool. Now, I have to ask you, what was the secret screening? Was it Charlie St. Cloud?
You know what sucks is the word that I got was that the secret movie screening, like the movie was on its way and for whatever reason it didn't make it. So they ended up having an encore screening of Rocksteady, but apparently it was a real big deal, whatever the secret screening was, and at the last minute it fell through.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, so I don't even know what it was. I'm hoping to get a confirmation of that soon. But as far as I know, it was a big one. It was one that everybody was really excited about. But Rocksteady was so loved that they decided, well, we'll just have an encore screening of this documentary about the roots of reggae. So that's what they did.
Cool. So right on. All right. Well, thank you very much, sir, for the report.
Thank you for letting me.
I want to go at some point for sure.
Absolutely.
If for no other reason, I didn't get over there to meet Ed and Greg.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Totally. You would love Ed and Greg. I had a great time with Ed and Greg, and they big fans of this show. So thank you, Ed and Greg, as always.
Cool. All right. Well, let's go ahead and talk about what's hitting theaters this weekend. Wow.
Do we have to?
Wow.
Yeah. Well, let me start with what's really exciting. Okay. In limited release, you got Love Ranch. This is Joe Pesci in a starring role. This is a big deal. Joe Pesci and Helen Mirren in a film directed by Helen Mirren's husband, Taylor Hackford. It looks crazy. It looks almost Scorsesean about this real chicken ranch, if you want to call it that, this whorehouse. It's dealing with, you know, issues of rights and basically going up against the system, opening up this whorehouse. But it's Joe Pesci in a starring role. I didn't think I'd ever get to say that again.
Yeah, was the last one Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag or whatever it was?
I think the last one he did was probably Gone Fishing.
Oh, wow.
And that was 1997. So, wow. Yeah. Yeah, so Love Ranch. So look for it if you can. If nothing else, we need to encourage Joe Pesci to return. He's such a great actor. I want to see more Joe Pesci movies. And then there's everything else. There's two more movies. They'll probably be pretty big, but...
not our demographic. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Opening Wednesday? Wednesday or Tuesday? A Tuesday midnight screening.
Wednesday,
so officially,
yeah.
Officially Tuesday. Twilight Eclipse.
Yay!
Which you get to see.
I'm seeing that tomorrow night. Julia, myself, and a screening room full of 11-year-old girls. So.
And soccer moms.
And soccer moms. Yeah, that's right. The Twi moms.
Yeah.
And then opening on Friday, you've got The Last Airbender. This is M. Night Shyamalan's obvious attempt to make a big commercial studio film after the gargantuan disaster of his last couple films, although The Happening made $60 million for some reason.
Well, I'm sure
has
it was
the advanced word on The Last Airbender. I feel like I've just seen like no early reviews or anything on it.
Yeah,
and I'm kind of worried about it.
Ain't It Cool's played a few and they're like, it's okay.
Oh yeah, Because they released that clip. It was like the this is the first and only clip in the movie. Like, isn't that bad when they're only going to show one clip of the film? And when all the trailers don't showcase any of the acting. And let's face it, in Shyamalan's best movies, even in The Village, he has showcased great, great acting. And this movie doesn't look like it's going to have one good performance. The special effects look great, no question. The special effects
look
very cool.
They look better than The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
They look fun. They look like a lot of fun. But if this is going to be a great movie, the trailer certainly does not indicate that.
I'll go see it as a take one for the team, I guess.
I will let you do that, sir.
Yeah, I think
okay.
I'm
okay. I just officially signed myself up.
Yeah,
I'm
I think
probably,
you are our big shining knight for this one, because I don't think I'm
going
to
like
see
look
this.
At Rotten Tomatoes on Wednesday or something. It's going to be like at 5% and be like, oh, crap. So.
Yeah.
Indeed. And yeah. Okay, so let's move on to DVDs, because there's some winners coming on DVD next week.
A film I really loved. This is probably one of my favorite films of the year, just by default. There's been so many few great films this year. But I love The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I want to warn people going to see it expecting just another thriller. The movie is not rated, but I believe it could be an NC-17. It's strong.
Kind of like Requiem for a Dream did.
Yeah. It has scenes of sexual violence that are definitely strong. So if you're going to sit down with your loved one and go, oh, this is going to be such a good thriller. Yes, it is a serial killer suspense thriller, but it's got some very, very strong things. So I recommend seeing it by yourself first before you decide. Let's watch it with the wife and kids. But no, great performances, really mesmerizing story. I really dug this film. It's very, very long. It's longer than it needs to be, but it's just top-notch. Also, another terrific movie. I love this film, and I don't know why this movie didn't win more Academy Awards or was up for more Academy Awards. A Single Man. Tom Ford's A Single Man, starring Colin Firth. Excellent, excellent movie.
That was my favorite movie of last year.
I don't blame you, man. This is a beautiful film, poetic film. If nothing else, thematically dealing with how love can do to you and how obsession can and love can intertwine. Just a great film, great movie. I love this movie. Excellent career best at this point performance from Colin Firth. Excellent performance from Julianne Moore. I love this film. I can't wait to see it again. And this is going to be one of these movies. If you can own it on Blu-ray, do it, because it's going to look great. The rest is not quite as good. Although I love this film. I'll mention this one. When people ask me, what's the best thing John Belushi ever did? People always mention Animal House or The Blues Brothers. He did one film that kind of showed the direction he was hoping to head in. He was hoping to become more of a dramatic actor. He did a film called Continental Divide. Continental Divide is a romantic comedy, but it's more of a serious John Belushi movie. It's John Belushi and Blair Brown. He is a reporter who goes to Colorado to do this story about this woman who lives out in the woods. It's a romantic comedy. It got terrific reviews. They were compared to Hepburn and Tracy when it came out. It wasn't very successful because I think Belushi's fans wanted him to be Bluto again. But Continental Divide is a very good film. Wonderful, wonderful romantic comedy. I highly recommend it if you love Belushi and if you love good romantic comedy. And then the rest, you've got Brooklyn's Finest, which I've heard really mixed things about. I want to see it because it's Wesley Snipes' first movie since Blade Trinity. So I want to see it because I like Wesley Snipes. But I've heard really, really mixed things about this.
Yeah.
And Ethan Hawke and Don Cheadle, of course, are also in the film. A movie that people remember very fondly from their childhood and they shouldn't. That's Rodney Dangerfield's Ladybugs.
I saw that. I was like,
available
ooh.
On Blu-ray. Yeah. This is
great
movie. Jonathan Brandis and Vanessa Shaw are also in the film. I'm sorry, but this is not Back to School. This isn't even Easy Money. It's not as good as you remember. The scene where Dangerfield and Jonathan Brandis dress in drag is a low in movie comedy. And then finally, a film that I need to see it again because I remember loving it when I saw it in 1994. But I don't think it's quite a great movie. Jimmy Hollywood from director Barry Levinson.
Oh, yeah?
With Joe Pesci and Christian Slater. Great performances from the two of them. Yes, Harrison Ford does make a surprise last-minute cameo in the movie, and it is quite a shocker. Sorry to give that away. Jimmy Hollywood, not a perfect movie. I don't even know if it's a great movie, but I remember loving the two lead performances, and it's definitely one of those middle-of-the-road Barry Levinson films. I should mention really quick, I saw Pollywood finally. I saw it on the plane.
Oh, okay.
I love Pollywood.
Yeah.
Loved Pollywood. That's an excellent film. It does manage to actually be very even-handed as opposed
it
to
does.
Being like one side or the other, dealing with how politics and celebrity sometimes do and do not mix. The movie takes place entirely at the Denver Democratic Convention. Yeah,
well, they do the Republican one too.
Yeah,
Rachel Lee Cook is the anchor of that movie. Totally.
Rachel Lee Cook is terrific. I mean, like so many great actors. I mean, you can see like Tim Daly and Hathaway, like really great sound bites from almost all the celebrities on hand. I love Pollywood.
Yeah.
Loved it. So that's really it this week.
Cool. Right on. You know, I thought we had an email. I can't pull it up right now. It's just being ornery, but it's all good. If you want to shoot us an email, by all means do. You can hit us at podcast, Barry, Ethan, or Dave, all at screengeeks.com. And we're going to have some fun next week. It'll be a good time. But until then, this is Dave.
This is Barry.
This is Ethan.
Take it easy.